Very long time ever since we sat in a boardroom like this as a portfolio committee. It was before COVID, the last time we sat in a boardroom like this. It feels very good. And you all look beautiful. in particular Chileka with a new hairstyle.
Thank you, sir.
She knew that they would be meeting for the first time, and then she went to the salon particularly for this meeting. So we really acknowledge your effort. Colleagues, let's start. Welcome to the meeting of the Portfolio Committee of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment. I suspect the meeting is being recorded.
Yes, sir.
Yes, and so that because the boardroom is relatively small, it's very important that we know each other, know who's here, and this is a public meeting. General interest will be important for us to know who's here. But everybody is welcome, and everybody is really allowed to participate. We have invited other people. I don't see them on the agenda. I suspect they did not confirm. That is because of the number of publications that they have made to us to come and present for us in a physical meeting. But it is not a problem. I suspect we'll still meet them in their respective province. My name is Ndidi Mudise. I am the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment.
My name is Tembeza Krumi. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
My name is Amiri Deva. I am from the Portfolio Committee. I'm also a member of the
Good morning, everybody. Bernard Gilman, also from the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment.
Good morning, all. Hiroshi Yangan, Parliament,
Legal and Environment. Good morning, everyone. My name is Nitin Goni from the Minister of Justice.
Good morning. Marco Schmidt from the German Consulate.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, I'm also the president of the Natural Resources Foundation. Good morning, Sandunani. Makusi Kawashi, from the Natural Resources Foundation and invited by the Women's Foundation.
Good morning. My name is Sinekuku Zukolu from the same Royal Court invited by the Women's Foundation. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Mandla Dlamini from the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You're all welcome. Our agenda is not really long. I am brief that there are people who have a flight to catch. Respected Mr. Zul.
Yes.
So in terms of the agenda, you will be the first to present to the committee, and then we will engage, and then we'll take Ms. Kawashi, and then we'll take the briefing by the department. Okay, can I check if there are apologies, Ms.
Yes, we received apologies from Honorable Kanjo, Honorable Singh, Honorable Kappa, Honorable Winkler, and Mr. Poston will arrive late. And then from the Department Minister, Deputy Minister, and the DG of the
Honorable.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other apologies, colleagues? Those who did not deposit their apologies are accepted. absent without apology. I don't have any apology. Okay, can we get the mover for the adoption of the agenda? Honorable Mbatha. Thank you. Can we get the seconder? Mabuela.
I second it.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go straight into it. The department has approached the portfolio committee because there is no route, there are no routes of engagement insofar as the climate change is concerned in the country. It is for the first time that this bill is introduced to the portfolio committee and the parliament on behalf of the republic. Now, we have started public processes and public engagement since February. We have been to various provinces. We've been to Mpumalanga, we've been to Gauteng, we have been to KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape. We have been to the Northern Cape. Over the past weekend, we were in the here in the Western Cape. We are now left with part of the Northwest and the Free State. Those are the only two provinces that are left. We have received over 13,000 applications. People continue to engage the committee on the views of this so far as climate change is concerned and how do they think they must have this bill and this law. There are a number of institutions that we have met on the virtual platform that have presented over and above those who are the first to appear before the committee physically. Other than the public consultations in various provinces, we've never had a meeting of this nature. So if we were in a big hall, I was going to say, you must give yourself a round of applause. But I don't want us to do that because the hall is a bit small, so it might be a bit noisy. With that being said, you are all welcome. Without further ado, let's invite Mr. Zukulu on behalf of the Wilderness Foundation to say, not too sure if you are going to apply to anything.
Yes, I'm going to. Yes.
So I might need to move from here.
Yes, please.
Quite well, you didn't know that I have eyes behind my head. So I can see what is happening here. But in the name of peace and progress, let me satisfy you and turn around.
Yes,
the platform is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. I come from rural areas, and you will pick up the health ticket later. So that I'll be showing you a perspective from a rural area work settlement. I come from Bondo land, the land of Amambondo in Bizana. So, and I'd like to show you in terms of what we experience, and some of the photos you see there, like the one you see is the experience during the flood. I just want us using lots of pictures to show you what it is like living through currently through climate change. Okay, I'm sure with all the thing, I'm not going to spend time on this. You know about this. We are running out of time. We need to do something. Next one. Yes, please. If we're looking at the current extractive world economy, we're drawing heavily and too quickly on already overdrawn environmental resource accounts to be affordable far into the future without bankrupting those accounts. So what we are doing today, you know, we are bankrupting the future generations from whom we are borrowing the national capital, what we have in the environment. They may show profit on the balance sheet of our generation, but our children will inherit the losses due to what we do today. And it's important to know that in terms of what we do on climate as well, so it is going to impact on the future generations. We borrow environmental capital from the future generations with no intention and or prospect for repaying them. They may then ask for our spending ways, but they can never collect on our debt to them. We act as we do because we can get away with it. Future generations do not vote, they have no political or financial power, they cannot challenge. So it is therefore very important that what we do today, decisions we take that into consideration, that we need to be as well, if we're talking sustainability, to think about the future generations. There are numerous calculations of South Africa's natural capital, including partial accounts conducted sector by SFA, in-country surveys done by the World Bank, most recently data book present 2017, offers calculations in which South Africa's mineral depletion, energy, mainly coal depletion, and immediate CO2 damage can be collectively costed at about 6.8% of the GDP each year, resulting in a net negative wealth. This is important to consider if we are going into the oil and gas economy with the mind where we're saying we are creating wealth. We must know that there's a huge debt that is related to that. Next slide. We know about the impact of the oil and gas. In terms of, again, the risk we are running into as we move into that, it's not just the emissions, but it's also the damage to the environment on which we as rural people are dependent on. So, again, so I'm not going to spend much time reading what's there. Again, if you're looking at in terms of what the seismic and the oil and gas economy in terms of the planning, if you are looking from the perspective of the environment, you know that the entire ocean is subdivided into those exploration plots. And so that if you look at the marine life and the whole biodiversity within our ocean. So, yes, let's go on to the next one. The highlighted red one, I'm trying to highlight there the number of affected sectors. When we go for this, the oil and gas in South Africa, there are other sectors that we are destroying. The next one. I've put in here the oil and gas exploration versus the strategic water source areas. If you, again, when you look at strategic water sources are the areas that are very critical in South Africa for water supply, that are supplying more than 50% of our water, all those blue areas, and most of them are within the mountainous ranges. So within the mountainous part of South Africa, the Drakensberg, you get down to the Cape, all of those are mountainous areas. Those are strategic water source areas, and it's very critical that as a country, when we are planning our extractive industry, that we work as hard as we can to protect that, because it's the lifeblood of our country. Next one. If you're looking at the oil and gas pipeline, and it does impact on those strategic water sources. Next one. For instance, if you're looking at some of the huge economies that we have, I come from the Eastern Cape. In the Eastern Cape, mainly in the Sardine Run, it's mainly about the ecotourism development because the filmmakers and all of that. When it gets to KZN, you know it's about the exploitation and how people go and net those sardines out. And nowhere in your special marine planning bill, in your oil and gas industry, these are being taken care of. So we're destroying what we have. Because we are perceiving that oil and gas will give us the world. Next one. Critical biodiversity areas. Again, I'll show you the map that shows currently, if you're looking, and that map didn't come up. But I'm now going to move down to local level, and I'm going to slow down and take you to the rural areas where I come from. So we are already experiencing climate change. In terms of the rainy season, we are seeing the increase in the number of storms. Under normal circumstances, our plowing season is September to January. The rainy season is usually September to March, and the dry season is April, May, June. But lately, heavy rain in April, this year again, has been also, we have been seeing new records in terms of rainfall. February, March, April, and May this year have been very severe with the rain bombs. And very localized. You have seen that Port St. John's, you saw the rain which happened there on the 23rd, 24th of March. But after that, recently, now this month, May, we've had rain. And those roads that were damaged have further been damaged now already. So we had rain bombs even on the 16th of March in my village. We had rivers got flooded within 2 hours because of this. So all of these things, they affect us directly. For instance, we rely, during winter, we rely on our sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes, if they get soaked with water, within 2 days, they will rot. Our millets, I've shown you the picture. That's a picture from Idlaza or Udlame, so we get the millets. Once you've got excess moisture, this heavy rainfall, even if you have harvested, so your harvest gets destroyed. Yams, amadumbe, they will not cook well. I would say ayatenga. So because of when they are soaked in, because those are normally the crops. So what I'm trying to say is that, yes, you can click. The damage to infrastructure, the damage to infrastructure to the road, that's the road that we use. From my village, we're crossing Mzamba to get to R61, we use that particular road. And that's the damage that happened in April last year. And the rescue or the reconstruction only came in November last year to fix that road. From April till November last year, we had to find a way to pass through that particular area, and it's the only road that we use to try to get to the two cases and side. So the increase in the pest in our crops, the wild weather, of course, in terms of in the wild coast, and how that would impact in oil rigs, and how often we have oil spills is another story. The climatic extremes, your droughts, your floods, your storms, which we are already experiencing. The livestock diseases, the amount in the recent floods, for instance, we had families that lost 6-7 cows in each family during those heavy rains. Like if you're looking at your April floods, for instance, click the next one. This the damage to infrastructure, next one. The pictures, they are self-explanatory. I'm not going to waste your time. And then the loss of livestock during these serious heavy storms and floods. Yeah. And next one. And people in rural areas, we all know that in all rural areas, there's still a big majority of people whose houses are built of mud, and those are your immediate victims. We say those are the most vulnerable people, and sometimes we wish those were the people that could be prioritized when it comes to your RCP houses, but it doesn't always happen. We know that's the story, what happens with the RCP. And then the other top photograph, top right-hand side corner, that's Nyameni Bridge. When you drive from Kolobeni, again going towards Port Edward, that bridge, that's the people who voluntarily after the storm, they had to come and fix. So, and again, the fixing of that bridge only by through municipality, with the funding, with the disaster money, it only came in the beginning of this year. So from April, so it took almost a year for the bridge. In the meantime, people need to cross. So what the story I'm trying to say, the rural people, the poor, the previously disadvantaged, are the most vulnerable people. And we must understand that when we choose a path that is going to see our emission increasing, we must know that the people that we are putting at risk more than anyone is the vulnerable people, is the poor people. Those countries, those corporations, where they are coming from, they are not going to be impacted directly. We must know that when we make that decision, when we think that oil and gas is going to create wealth, but the people, the most vulnerable, and the people who are putting at the forefront of facing the impact of climate change, the most vulnerable people are the poor people. And that's the pain I'm trying to help you see with these pictures and with my presentation. And when you are looking at the climate change bill, for me, my immediate question is to say, how is the climate change bill going to enable those people to bounce back? And what are the time frames when people lose their livestock in those rural areas? When those bridges get washed away, I've told you how long it took for our bridges to be fixed. So how is the climate change bill enabling those poor people to be able to bounce back? If you are looking at the death of people in Durban last year, the most vulnerable are those people living in shacks, in those slums or shacks in those townships. But so it's very critical that when we come up with a bill or the climate change legislation has got to address, because if we go for the oil and gas economy, we must know that we are increasing the emissions, we are making worse the impact of climate change, and the people at the forefront that are going to experience that is the poor more than anything. And then therefore, how is this bill going down to the bottom? If the people, their houses get washed away and then they need shelter, how is this bill addressing that? How is it enabling? If people during this climate change impact, their livestock die, their crops, they are destroyed, how is the bill addressing that? How is it enabling those people to quickly bounce back? People who have got those companies that are coming to mine oil and gas, they have insurance. If they are damaged, they are able to bounce back. But those poor people in the rural areas, and also you must bear in mind the money to fix all the infrastructure, to get those houses, whether it is reimbursement or compensation, needs to come from government. So the cost of the climate change, you must know that that's the money that needs. Do we have that money? Are we going to be able to? So in terms of when we think about the climate change, we are putting together the deal, we have got to stick to the realities. And I'm sharing the story from the ground. Can you click for the next slide, please? The alien invasive plants are another story. Those are the gum trees. Again, that's a story from my village. And those alien plants, they are spreading because there's too much carbon in the air. As a result, we are getting more and more alien invasive vegetation is springing up everywhere. And now, because of the spread of the alien invasive, your gum tree, your wattle, your buckwheat, your lantanas, your cromolinas, so because they are growing up everywhere due to the amount of carbon in the air, now the next problem we have is huge fires, and those fires, they burn down houses of the poor people. Click the next one, please. Just keep on clicking. This is showing you the alien invasive vegetation, which is increasing due to, and then as a result of the problem of fires, please just continue to click to show the impact which is associated, and this is all directed to climate change. So when we're talking about the future, continue. And all of those houses were surrounded by these massive areas of alien invasive vegetation, because alien invasive vegetation, they actually. And then I want to show you now pictures from the city. Again, the poor, You look at the people who are at the forefront of being impacted directly and the most vulnerable. Yes, next one. So, therefore, for me, if you are therefore, can you please go back to the previous slide? So, therefore, it's important that your climate change policy has got to be coming up with solutions to the challenges. How are the poor? And we must know that as we continue as a country to promote the oil and gas and increasing our emissions, we are exacerbating the climate change. So, and when we're putting together the policy, does it bring solutions to these most vulnerable? And also, what budget is the climate change policy enabling that would be able to help people to bounce back? And how is the policy putting together way to react to the devastation? And how at village level, how does the climate change policy go down to the lowest level, at a village level, to that Induna or the subhetman or the council of elders, to be able to say, how do we help the victims? These are the people, they lose their livestock, their huts, their collapse. People whose house collapsed in April last year, they have to fend for themselves. They still have no houses now in rural areas, in my village. So it's important for us to understand. Climate costs are enormous. And the things I was as showing you from rural areas, those are some of the costs of climate change, so of that impact. But also when we look in terms of the economic figures, they are enormous. The next one. In International Monetary Fund, there's a whole lot of studies that show us in terms of South Africa, 2020 GDP is going to be about $4.21 billion. And if we're looking at how much money, the studies that have been done by IMF, studies done by the various universities showing the cost per ton of carbon when you consider all the impact. So we are moving in, when we increase our carbon emission, we are putting a pressure on our budget to be able to pay, because that the emission, the emission that we're increasing, we're going to have to pay for that. Next one. And if you are, at least as our trading partners pursue the goal of net zero carbon emissions, they are likely to increase the restrictions on the import of goods produced using carbon intensive energy. Because we are increasing our, so that the carbon tax is going to be on us, and that's going to require money. Those, all of those things, they need to be factored into our policy, into our budget, into our planning. We must know that when we move to the carbon economy, when we continue to move into that economy, we are increasing pressure on our budget spend through the carbon tax. What needs to be done? Strategic environmental assessment needs to be done for the ocean before we can be able to say we're going AWOL with that. The claims of wealth versus evidence of wealth creation is so important, not to rely on claims to say we are creating wealth, but to be able to make sure that we are able to prove now that when we move into that to the carbon economy through oil and gas, we are going to be creating wealth. And the reality is that when you look at the economic figures, you will see that we are going to, we're moving the country into a very costly economic figures. There is no protection of the vulnerable people. It's important that in policy we make sure that this policy is able to protect the vulnerable. And if we are calling the oil and gas economy development, I wonder whose development and what benefit. If we say it will create jobs, how many jobs? Do we have those figures to be able to act and say? So because if we have the paper trade, we are able to turn around in the next 20, 30, 40 years and say, and be able to challenge what was put in front, instead of verbal claims that people make and say, we will be a rich country if we move into this economy. Thank you very much, Jefferson.
Very busy today. I'll be moving from one chair to the other. Thank you very much. Dr. Zubul. colleagues. That is the story of my staff. I invite you to engage the presentation. Yeah. Honorable Mbata, Honorable Chumi, Honorable Ryan. Yeah.
Thank you for being the honor for the presentation. Yes, I will change that.
We put the mic on this first.
Not really. I don't have a short show of the photo, but thank you for the presentation. I think we should be understanding that climate change cuts across all the departments.
Yes,
it's under environment, but it cuts across all the departments. Because it's true, when the floods affect the crop, which is under agriculture, the infrastructure is going to another department. And when there's such a disaster, it goes to disaster management. I'm trying to highlight this because the bill won't be able to tackle all those issues, because I believe it's a situational based policy on climate change, and there are other policies. The NEPA Act and so forth, there has been the climate change minister emphasizing issues, particularly on climate change, and how it is going to be implemented, and how the department will monitor the offenders, especially those who will pollute the environment to a scale. Giving us a negative impact on the climate change. So some of the issues that we have raised here, it falls under the municipality or under the department and the culture and so forth, under disaster management. We are during the disaster, there will be different departments that will form a casting that will deal with all the issues that we I know that even the private sector now, they show me that those that are dealing with the infrastructure, they started to have conferences, just to have a discussion on how climate change affects the infrastructure. But while dealing with that, you need to know that in all new developments, there must be an approval where the geologist or the engineer must sign that new development plan to confirm that the last plan of that new development won't affect some of the part of the natural resources and won't be affected by floods. With the last span of 100 years, not less than 100 years. So in most other cases, in the teachers, what I realized is the issue where people have been put there without the proper plan. Some of the areas where they are, we know in our informal sector, informal settlements, they are not supposed to be there, but it's put itself because they want the place to live. Certainly in most cases, they are the ones who are mostly affected when it comes to this disaster or through climate change. being on the issue of the of more plants that have been, the onion plants that have been that are now growing more in number. I think we have, especially in the rural area, the must be, I think we are one of the people that are dealing with this issue. To plant more trees that are producing more oxygen. In the issue of the climate change. With the oil activities, yes, it's a no-no because it affects the animals that are living in the fish, my mind. But all of them, they are being affected, and we also promise the sea. Of which most of the case with the environmental activities they usually fight against it. It shouldn't happen. I think the last one that was popular was the shell one, of which there were so many opposing messages to say it mustn't go through because it has an impact of affecting the lives of the animals in the sea and also the climate change. So I think from your side, I wanted to ask what activities do you have in mind, because I think you are nearer to the poor of the forest. What activities or programs do you have in order to assist in the climate change issue, like creating awareness and also trying to be our eye and ears, because you can't have the human eyes all over, but when we are there, you know there is a problem of emissions, then you know that which area or which department or municipality section is where you report immediately so that they come and ask you. I wanted to ask if you have such problems so that you can assist on the creation of the knowledge and awareness on the climate change issue. Because yes, climate change is a new thing to us. Those certain areas, around about some of the certain areas, you know,
in 2017,
where the minister, by then was minister, examiner, and the social resources. But I've learned from other countries that you need to have situational-based policies per situation until all your issues are resolved. Because we can't have one policy. Yes, we have our Bible, which is the Lima Act, but out of the Lima Act, those are policies of which I believe they are situational-based in order to resolve our problems.
I will stop. And the impact on the gas emissions. Your presentation indicates that you want that to be also featured in the climate change field. But my question, and that's fine, have you done a study? I know that you, I heard that you said you are asking for something that is written that is going to indicate the number of jobs that will be created and the economic growth projection. Have you done a study that is going to assist in saying in terms of how do you balance this issue of economic growth versus the environmental impact? And once you have those two combined, how can you strike a balance on that, on those two? Given the fact that South Africa is in South Africa, we have a lot of a high level of unemployment, high level of poverty, and we still need to do that. But at the same time, we are faced with the environmental factor, which is now which we all know as climate change, as we have been presenting them. And the second question is based on the climate change bill, that have you gone through it as a bill, as it is presented, and as you were going through it, were you able to find the role that can be played by the Wilderness Foundation in all these proposals that are made through the bill? Currently, I know that it talks about the social engagement in different levels, even different levels of government, up to the presidency. Are you able to locate where you can play a role? And if you can, do you see yourself participating in this processes? Because it's a the bill provides for long term for a long term engagement and for a long term review, and I think it presents the opportunity for all the stakeholders to participate. And when if you have done so, and if you have you can place them. Wilderness Foundation can play a role and can have a significant role to play. What is it that you think can be done, and how do you think can we decide this presentation? How do you think you can positively contribute for the benefit of this climate change bill to be effective and impactful?
Thank you. Honourable Brian, I just have one question. Sorry, I think I speak very loud, but I'll switch on the mic. thank you for the presentation. I just have one question with the invasive and alien species. I'm not sure how we link that to climate change, but I do understand that within our communities we need to get rid of them, but we also need to replace them with other trees, because the greening is very important. So I would like to know if the communities that you talk about and that horrible photos that you showed us about the invasive plants, which is really bad, is there not a way that you guys can cut it up and help for, you know, forward and then replacing with other trees? And to me that is a community project, and I would like to know if you do involve in something like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honourable Brian?
Yeah. Thanks very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. It was good to hear directly from people on the ground who are being impacted by the effect of climate change on a regular basis. We often hear about climate change as being something that's going to happen. I think we know as a committee that it's something that is happening as we speak. And I think your first, one of your first slides, you have a quote there that says, we act as we do because we can get away with it. And I think that's why this climate change report is so important, that we can make sure that we put those provisions in place, and that we've got to be so valuable. just one or two points that stuck out to me that I think is important to address. The first one is what you mentioned in terms of impact on subsistence farming and the impact of rain bonds, as you mentioned. Intensive periods of rain, I think a lot of people do not directly involved in agriculture, such as myself, often think about rain as being so vital to run across the country, to have far too much rain, as we demonstrate. And then also the impact on people's homes, and particularly mud homes, which I think is something that is quite unique to certain parts of South Africa, and perhaps not others, although the impact of flood definitely do touch everybody who's staying in the rural and rural areas. And then the last point is the point around jobs. And so just to link those two things, I think the first one in terms of the impact on farming and the impact on homes, and we showed the roads as well that have been washed away. I think it's one of the reasons why we have to focus a lot more on the adaptation side of climate change. Something that we're getting from around the world, as much as we'd like to be able to mitigate the impact of climate change, we have to be very cognizant of the fact that it's happening so fast that we have to ensure our communities are prepared and equipped. A lot of that comes through the delivery of municipal services as well, making sure that the drain and sewer systems are working properly, making sure that our roads are well maintained, etc. And that also then goes to the issues around farming, making sure that we adapt farming practices. And then in terms of jobs, and I'm not sure how much you've engaged with the just transition discussion. I'm sure it's a big part of what you might be looking into, but I think that's directly what a lot of us are speaking to. We're showing that the jobs that are being created within the renewable energy space, but I think potentially also within the adaptation space, bring in people from all economic backgrounds, so that we're not really from a fossil fuel intensive industry that provides a lot of low level jobs for people, who are emerging mines and that kind of thing, and then a renewable sector which is going to provide jobs which require a high level of education and training. We need to make sure that we get that balance right so that nobody gets left behind. So I think we'll put inputs are really valuable when it comes to just the energy transition. And thank you again for joining me.
Yes.
Thank you, Honourable Bosan.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you? Very well, you.
I like you, sir.
Think about the principal used to do that to me at school. And when you arrive late, he just says, that question. And he knows very well you're not prepared. Welcome, Honorable Portion. Mr. Zubul, just on my side, you agree with me that all the questions are inexplicably telling. But I'm thank you for the presentation. I'd like to know, over and above presenting to the portfolio committee, where else have you been? What other role have you played? Where else have you spoken to about climate change and its impact? In your engagements with whoever, and what were the response? Are they helpful? Do they understand the impact of climate change and were they taken by the pictures that you shared with us, like where you were? But in your respective communities in the rural Tsonga, are we having, linked with the question of Honorable Mbatha, are we having this climate change awareness programs? Do we have people talking about it? Getting to understand that it's not just an ordinary rain and floods, at times droughts. Do we have people talk about it? But lastly, I those questions that you asked in your last slide, Mr. Zulu, maybe you must start answering them first. You know, then we'll try and answer them. I'm indirectly saying, Mr. Zulu, what are the fair proposals you want to put before the committee, so that they can be incorporated into the final draft, you know, before it becomes a law? What are the pieces you want to maybe subtract or get into the current draft? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, if I would say one of the things that I would very much is the implementation of the climate change bill, in particular the gentleman referred to the adaptation, what we call in climate change nature-based solutions or ecosystem-based adaptation are very critical. And it is something that sits at the lowest level, as correctly pointed out by Honorable Mbatha, by through municipalities. So in my work, I think to sum up, I have many years of working in the climate change space. For instance, in Alfred Nzo, which would mean Matatiel, Mount Frey, Mount Ellington, Davangulu, Mbizana, and all of that, as part of the team that back in 2015 already did a vulnerability assessment in that district. We did a climate change strategy. I was working for Conservation South Africa back then. And then we established climate change committees within co-hosting with the district municipality. Just last year, I facilitated the climate change strategy, which was a review for Mbizana, which is Mnamathengwe la Mandela municipality. So I've been involved over the years in terms of the eradication of the alien invasive vegetation. So in terms of the work, and the work is ongoing in terms of helping people to understand. I work with farmers. I think we have about 10 farmers forums where we are advocating for agroecology, how to farm in a manner that adapts to climate change, in a climate smart agriculture. We are doing, but of course when you do that work as a civil society, you can do to a limited extent. In terms of the for instance, the question of fires and how I recently addressed the disaster management of the district municipality, Alfred Nzo, and I was invited to come and talk about the link between alien invasive vegetation and climate change to address there in terms of why are we having such a serious problem. And as the years go by, the problem of fires and the disaster, people do not understand the link and how climate change is exacerbating the challenge they have with fire. So in my line of work, I have a Master of Philosophy in Environmental Management, and I do lots of that. So I'm talking from experience. I take the lessons from the ground and write those up into articles published to really show what's happening. So I'm talking from the experience of the work that I've been doing over the years that I continue to do. As I'm saying, it was only beginning of this month, it was end of April, when I was invited to talk, to the House of Traditional Leaders within the district about traditional leaders establishing bylaws within their communities in terms of dealing with the fires, making fire breaks and all of that. And so there's a whole lot of that, but we can only do so much. Of course, we are not government, because the civil society organizations work at a local scale and are very limited. So there's a whole lot of work that is happening. Amongst other things, I work with young people. I've got 300 young people under my wing that I mentor and help them to understand the issues and what is at stake. And we require millions of those initiatives everywhere. I can only work within that particular scale depending on what resources I have. So there is a whole lot of work happening and the work which needs to be done. And and the little that we can afford there. Of course, one of the challenges is that once you have the bill, in South Africa, you know that we are popular globally for having some of the best legislation. And our challenge is that once we have those legislation, they are not getting implemented. The implementation, the same thing applies to this. And hence I'm saying, we need to be careful. It's very easy to have a legislation, but you often you find that even our NEMA bill is sitting here above the head of the ordinary people on the ground. And the biodiversity that needs to manage is sitting at a village level. And when you have got a legislation that does not have, that does not translate to the lowest level on the ground, but ends in a district office of a state department, then you have a serious problem. Because those officials are not going to have the budget to work with each and every village. But when you have got a bill that goes down to traditional council, that goes down to village level, where people have got a responsibility. Hence, I'm saying, with the adaptation to climate change, with all of those things, with all of those various departments, with your disaster and all of that, so it needs to get down there to say disaster people, how do they respond and all of that. And also that working together with the various sectors and various departments in terms of, but at the end of the day, if we have a legislation but it doesn't solve the challenges on the ground that are faced by the people on the face of climate change, then it doesn't help us. That's why I'm raising this, is for you to understand. That's why I've chosen to spend more time in terms of the studies, Honorable Mtunu. There are studies, there are cost benefit analysis studies which are out there. If I need to collect those and send to the portfolio committee secretary the studies that have been done, I'm happy to do so, to talk to climate scientists. I'm not a climate scientist, but I am a foot soldier on the ground in terms of community development and also ensuring that communities are able to adapt to climate change. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Zulu. Are there follow-ups, colleagues, from the food soldier?
This might be the question about the alien and invasive plants.
Alright. What happens is that when you have got increased amount of carbon dioxide in the air, that supports the growth of woody vegetation. For instance, the studies that we have done in Africa and so have shown that places that are grasslands today, in 8 years to come, they will be savanna bushveld because of the increased carbon. But linked to that, coupled with that, is that the carbon amount that you have exacerbates the growth of the alien invasive vegetation. You have got your bush encroachment into rangelands, into grazing areas. You have got the spread of water. Those who have been in the highlands, on the mountainous areas, they know that silver water is spreading like hell up on the island. So, and on the coast we've got a problem, the indigenous forests are also being suppressed and they are dying from the spread. That's due to the increased amount of carbon. So increased carbon in the air, as a result, in Bizana is about 50 kilometers away from the coastal thicket, those trees you find on the sand dunes. But in 80 to 100 years time, Zana will be part of the coastal thicket. That's what the scenarios and what the forecast from the climate change scientists. So therefore, we are going to be seeing the places that are grasslands today in South Africa moving and becoming the savanna bushveld because of the increased amount of carbon. And therefore, and so, and something coupled with that is the spread of alien invasive vegetation. So we are seeing the spread of aliens in places where they've never been seen before. But alien invasive vegetation has got a power that when it catches alive, so fires is like you have put in paraffin, the way that the fire spreads. And if people have not been careful about the amount of alien invasive vegetation around their houses, so the houses, they easily catch a light, so it, which therefore requires people to adapt by catching, making fire breaks and pushing back those alien invasive vegetation. So that's what is happening, and there's a lot within the internet. there's a whole lot. When you say link between alien vegetation and climate change, there's a whole lot of easy information there, and I can always send the links of the reference material to that maybe. Thank you.
Okay, I just want to follow up. My actual question was actually, is the community that you're talking about doing something as a community to get rid of the alien plants, or do they just, like you said, keep them away from their houses? Is there an active plan in the community to sort of control and manage this and get rid of these alien invasive plants?
In my talks, I've been doing workshops for the disaster risk reduction, disaster management in the municipality, where therefore we expect the officials to be able to go to all the wards that have got this problem to be able to find the means and ways. And we are giving them the ideas in terms of what could be done. So in other words, the awareness we are raising within the district level, so that with the expecting therefore to filter down. To ward levels, we bring it to the councillors so that for them to understand this is almost the challenge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zubulu. Are you not getting it?
I am planning late.
Yeah. Instead of getting cold, you're on the
No. I'm very warm. I would have to start if I was getting cold.
Yeah.
I am worried about my plane.
Yeah. No. We will hope that you will have to rush for a flight. Thank you very much for presenting to the committee.
Thank you.
We hope to connect with you in the future via the Wilderness Foundation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We don't need a comfort break.
The next is another medical plan.
Yes.
The next is another medical plan. Show.
Does not have a flight or a flight.
Flight. PowerPoint.
I thought we were only a problem with the flight.
No, flight.
Okay, you have Tabashi? Do I pronounce it correct?
Tabashi. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for restoring honour to the United Forum. Thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to do this. I will not be very long because I think Nepal has been quite well placed the issue on the ground where I come from. I've been a traditional healer for 23 years now, and our problem. While we would support the bill is because of the impact that we are seeing already. Medicinal plants in the state are at risk. We're already seeing shortages, which, yes, it's easy to say that maybe it's over harvesting, but the very real impact of the change in climate is affecting where and how much of some of our plants are growing. Already we are starting to see some of the plants being extinct or no longer growing in the local locations where they used to be. So that's a massive impact on us. The second place where we are seeing the impact of climate change is on the increasing level of poverty, which is happening in communities. And why this is something that I don't know if we think about enough. If you take the situation of washing away of grains in our culture, that's a sacred space. And when grains are washed away, when our people have to experience that trauma of seeing crops that they've grown being destroyed. In Tegeren, 2 years back, there was hail within a week apart, 2 feet of hail that destroyed completely. Crops that have been grown. When you have to deal with the trauma of having to figure out where your relatives are, because that's the reality of people. When you have to deal with the impact of the losses that you see there when people's homes are destroyed. Culturally, that is a level of even the word trauma doesn't quite mean it, and yet that is something that we see as missing, is that we treat these as just events, but we're not looking at the deeper impact of it that we get to see as Abelaphi. And remember that the problem with this is that as in suspicion sometimes, and when the levels of poverty rise, we tend to go against each other. I'll make my point by story, leave some on the story, is that in one of the villages where there was hail, the first round of hail, that house did not get any damage. The concern in the village was that what are other people going to say? Because we know that people can send you hail and all kinds of things. That's our belief system, whether you are in it or not. Fortunately for them, and I say fortunately in inverted commas, the next week when the storm came again, they also had damage and flooding. Their problem or concern was not about the flooding, but what they said was, at least we are fine, we are now all the same, we can impact it equally. Those are the realities of what is happening psychologically to people with the impact of the climate change, which some people understand and others don't, but all we know is we are living through and we are experiencing it. Now, the other issue is the movement of diseases that we see. Because all of a sudden, if areas are becoming wetter, we are seeing a lot more people coming through with issues of chest and things like that. And in other areas, the movement of malaria, Malaria, is now moving to places where the local community has never had experience with it. How are they going to interpret this illness that comes the way that it comes, taking into account how we understand things? And so, in the bill, it does speak about adaption, and it does also speak about even the intergovernmental framework. For my sins in my past life, I've worked in an SOC, so that intergovernmental framework, the way it works, is supposed to work and how it actually works, is something else. Because this bill requires coordination amongst governments, all levels of government. Because if you are not going to be able to make sure that we are taking care of the people on the ground, as Dr. Nikko has spoken about, as I'm talking about, including being able to get interventions which start talking to us as Abelaphi about possibilities of new diseases that are going to be emerging in the scene, so we don't misdiagnose people, because that propensity is also in there. So our biggest concern is that climate change comes with a lot of interpay. I don't know what the English word is, because it's not just about poverty. But it's beyond just poverty, but also a lot of anxiety that comes to communities. And anxious communities are not healthy communities. And if your communities are not healthy, that also spreads. And that is where our concern is. So as much as we support the bill, coming back to it, we are concerned about the lack of specific timelines for some of the interventions. One. Secondly, also the sanctions for the transgressors. There are only two sanctions, if my memory serves me well, in there, which are still also to be properly ventilated, and so we don't know at which point that is going to happen. The third area for me which is of concern is that there's I'm going to call it an inordinate, in my view, focus on financial redress, talking about carbon taxes. But capital and the corporate sector don't pay those things, put any mind, because it's easy to budget for your damage you're going to cause. But as a community whose complete life has been washed away, giving you money does not replace that. There's no redress at all in any of the provisions, which for me is a harder sanction than just saying something to pay money. anyone can put aside money. But if your fields have been destroyed and they give you money, you still don't have food. You still have to, there's a whole circle in there. If you have to rebury people, what lead this is there? People can throw money at you, but you are still left with that trauma. So for me, the fact that there is an actual regret built into the building is a massive, massive weakness that we do need to put into place, including regret directed at even municipalities that don't do what they are supposed to do. Because if I'm going to have excessive flooding and the warnings are out there and we don't have stormwater drainage, how? Because that's what happens, right? Is that all the risk gets shifted to us as a community, and other people can walk away. It's we who lose our home. It's we who lose our livelihood, while other people continue, as if, you know, their lives continue. If the element of redress is not addressed, then for me that is a big gap in this legislation that I don't think we will ever be able to overcome, because people will throw money at a problem, and for us money does not fix the problem. And so I'm going to say lastly is that the bill, if this is urgent, it could be overdue in a lot of ways. The coordination or lack of it in government is about decision making, which has direct climate impact effects, which I think is what Nicole was also talking about, and the continuation of it is also problematic, because we can't be talking about mitigation and strategies and adaption and sectoral, all of that, and yet we are also in, at the same time, making decisions which contribute to those gases in some way or form. And so we do need to urgently find implementers so that we also enforce, because there must be some kind of way of making sure the coordination actually does happen across and in all the levels so that people benefit. Now, in closing, and I'm preempting a question from the chair about what have you done, one of the realizations we have is that just because you're from a rural area or Misangoma or Uinyanga, people assume you know about the environment and that you are in touch with the environment. And so what we started doing is actually bringing that ethos back by starting to engage healers about their role as custodians of the natural environment. Is that, what does that mean? You know, how are you engaging with it? But with that being said, if the relevant institutions of government are not coming in to support us, there will only ever be small localized interventions without them getting to the scale that they need. Because whether people like it or not, agree with it or not, the majority of South Africans still come and consult Abilak in for their health care, which includes psychosocial care. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, I invite you to engage without preempting, for presentation, Honorable Mbatha.
Not being involved
the directory for traditional health practitioners. All provinces also have for their offices. And of course, all we call it dentist's offices. They have that unit that is focusing on the traditional health practitioners. I know that I'm one of the traditional health practitioners and I'm one of the people that were running that program under the health promotion unit, where we link the traditional health practitioner under with the primary health care. Because when primary health care is well discussed, and create awareness and do training on all issues of how diseases related to your practice, your practice, such in here. When we train the traditional health practitioner on all diseases that are there and those outbreaks, during any outbreak, the first people that we touch is the traditional health practitioner, because we believe that we are the first traditional doctors to see the community. If some of your patients don't prefer to go directly to the clinic or hospital, but they prefer to come to you so that you have a link, then you transfer. You transfer them or you refer them to your nearest clinic or hospital. This is how in RSA, how we are making it. It's based on World Health Organization, primary health care, Ottawa Charter, where I think where it's in China, where in most cases, the offices of the traditional health practitioners are linked directly inside the primary health care, either the hospital or the clinic, so that there's that link and there's no confusion. And I know that all the diseases that we are being trained with them so that you understand them, the way the medical doctors understand them, because in some of the things, they don't mean the same thing in different issues. So they differ very well, but if you know them exactly and you can link them and you can detect. But why we did that? Because some of the patients will focus on the traditional treatment rather than the medical treatment. Instead of trying to incorporate both of them, then you end up losing a life. But since then it has worked, there is that under health care, under health commission that has been done. I know even now we have cholera in the housing. Immediately the first people that we charge is the traditional health practitioner. So some will think that it's not medically associated with something else, maybe they believe the person then will go to the traditional health practitioner. So I wanted to highlight that there is that training that is there. But also on the issue of the where the producer, the country is the big company, we have other pieces of legislation. We have the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which says if you must protect your own employees and the nearby community, even the visitors that are coming to you, in case of any disaster within the company, then the old the inspectors, they come in, but there's a payment, a fine, it's included in the old inspector. If your house has been damaged based on my company, health hazard, then I must also bring this law has keep your house and everything. It's just that you need to understand that the climate change will have other pieces of legislation from other departments that will link with whatever they are saying that this is the protection of this. In the new act, it's where it says extended to discipline where the countries must take. And not only change, rehabilitate what the damage that the person has done. So there's different pieces of legislation that come in and work on. I think the department will also support this different pieces of legislation. Like I said, climate change cuts across all departments. But I think maybe we are coming from KZN. We need to check from the national office how can we link your office, not you alone, all of you there, because it's different types of African healer that need to work together and make the change together. So it's very important that we have empowerment all the time, especially when we're using and other things that may affect your practice as a traditional health practitioner. This is what I wanted to say, that thanks for what you have said. And I think the department is here, and as we are here, we have to look and how best can we assist. But in some areas, we find that they are plants in your head, but you can't assist them. Because they are in an area where it's closed or reserved, so you can't enter there. I usually ask them the question to say, on those heads, do they give you chances to say on a certain period you can come and take some but not kill the whole plant? You take some and you allow the plant to grow again, and they usually say,
mitigation adaptation strategies on a localized level for studies, so issues around building practices, where to build or not to build. Just one note that you can do currently or play with them in that state and that state.
Have your risk of being preempted? I just wanted to check.
No, I wanted to say something before you think.
I realize.
But when I see my head, didn't want to really, I mean, to go out because
I realize.
I don't know what else.
I was shocked the way you are looking at me.
Because I'm handsome, yes. No, I am handsome.
Yes.
No, you look handsome, but I'm handsome. No, towards the clock.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. No, my you have spoken about the question of teaching the healers to be custodians of environment, safe and clean environment. I'm not sure what plan that you do have on a sense to say you are using these indigenous trees and plants for question of healing. Then at the end of the day you find out sometimes some of those things are being destroyed. Now, I'm not sure the program or the plan that you have of trying by all means to protect this kind of indigenous tree. Sometimes that doesn't only happen on indigenous tree, you haven't even found out the question of this protected animal. So you find that it's being used, therefore, thrown in the river. she has spoken about the question of cholera, therefore it might be able to create some of these other things. What best that we can be able to think the bill can be able, I mean, can have it, so that I can be able to think about those things, how to protect some of these other issues, so that now each and every time whatever is happening, therefore we know that now we have a collaboration between ourselves and even better, the old, I mean the healer, and know about that. Then I'm not sure whether there is any coordination between yourselves and the National Traditional Healers Association, not only around in KwaZulu-Natal but all over the country, so that I can be able to hear, to understand their own perspective on the issues that now I'm talking about and what other members have just said. Thank you.
Thank you, the role of indigenous knowledge in climate change mitigation. What is the role of indigenous knowledge in climate change mitigation? I'm sure you did not pay attention. Very sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can respond.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for the question. Members, I don't want to go into the politics of the National Department of Health and where the status of health nationally and traditional leaders is, because it's a mess, and I try to leave it at that because it then goes into other areas. The intentions are all there, but the actual implementation of what should be there is something else. I mean, it's only 2 weeks back that the interim council, the new one, was put in place, so, and that's supposed to be looking after the crisis. But this is not so here. So I appreciate what you say is in place, but I'm very involved in the traditional healing space, including having to become an activist for our own incorporation and an engagement with us in different spaces. But like I said, that one is still coming up. So the issue about allocation of space, especially outside of municipal areas where you've got town planning and all of that infrastructure, is a problem, because there's such a high demand. If you just go outside of the boundaries, just the municipal boundaries, there's such a high demand for land and housing from people without any, or have to leave the rural areas to come even into the peri-urban areas, means that you are putting structures where they shouldn't be. We are putting, and because of this 100-year flood line thing that people don't understand, is that you will get to a place that used to be dry, and all of a sudden there are, you know, there's housing on there, and then the weather changes, and then we find those disasters happen. So it is a huge problem. Even if you travel, you will just be able to even see. But I'm even going to say, I'm going to extend it to just even beyond just only in the rural areas, because frankly, if you look at Mjordi and Balita, there's no reason why you should be building on that. The recent flood of last week, in fact, you can see that they're busy putting in very expensive houses on mud. And the very same disaster is going to happen, and if no one is saying this shouldn't be happening, I mean, I don't know who's supposed to be doing it. So it is a problem. The town planning issues are massive when it comes to how we're housing people and the demand versus appropriate places we can actually put in dwellings that will make sure that people have safe housing that is appropriate for humans into the foreseeable future. So that is something that has to be understood. The question of the collaboration is a deep one, because as much as there are permits that are given, you've got to apply for a permit to go and harvest, there's very little ongoing training and support, even to wild harvesters. So because of the situation of people needing employment and making money, if you go to any of the medicinal plant markets, whether it's Mona Market, you can go to Ezimuzin, you can go to Faraday in Joburg, you can go to Marabasa, you're going to find a massive amount of plant material, one, being sold by young people who don't know about the plant, but they are selling a commodity. So the commodification of our medicine is massive. because there's a demand and there are people who are willing to do it in order for them to make an income. So there are huge challenges there. We have engaged quite extensively with the department to be able to say there are standards for sustainable wild harvesting. You can teach people how to harvest even bark sustainably without killing trees. You can teach people how to sustainably harvest anything basically. But it means that needs to be supported somehow in order for that to start being happening. That capacitation that needs to happen in the practice is not happening as much as it should. If we were still in a situation where the harvesting was being done by Inyanga for own use, we wouldn't be sitting with the same problem. But right now we've got people who harvest to sell. You know, and that's why if you, the market, I'd be very happy to take you to just Faraday market. Because if you're someone who understands conservation and environment and you see the volume of material there, it shocks you because you've got to ask what is happening in the wild, where this comes from. There was a process with the Operation Pakistan to identify strategic medicinal plants for cultivation. But as we all know, you know, our plant sciences on medicinal plants is a little bit lagging, so we're not yet as advanced as your Chinese, where they're even telling the size of the seed that it should be, how you propagate it, etc., etc. So it's slowly, and I think that the pace of it is a little bit too slow to keep up with what is happening in the environmental changes. So it's a very big challenge. The willingness is there to collaborate because we all understand when you go and you're looking for a pepper, you're not going to find it. And it's a powerful medicine because it's finished and it's now coming from Lesotho into South Africa. And so when we finish it in Lesotho, what next? So we understand those, but I think it's the capacity to be able to then say, so what? What is it that I can do? Which is what for me is going to be important to see how we get out of that. The role of it is very important, Chair, very important, but the loss of it is the bigger problem, because maybe it's our own fault that we don't document enough, because even just understanding how you actually harvest from a tree, where you build a house, so what we've really eroded is even the rules around where you build or how you build, how do you respond in terms of our own indigenous knowledge in actually coming up with these adaptation and mitigation strategies. Because in Makaya, they will tell you that at this time, when the rain has done this, we then don't plant that, we move to something else. But it's now becoming quite specialized and not widely known knowledge. And because of our inability to transmit beyond the immediate circle, this indigenous knowledge. But it's crucial. I mean, it's crucial. Even globally, what it is that where people live the way they've always lived, they live in harmony with nature, which means that we are able to adapt to what is happening in the same way that animals do, actually. But the minute is that fragmentation, then it causes those disconnects. Thank you.
Are there follow-ups, honorable members?
I just would like to make a comment, and please don't trouble the phone. But you mentioned something that's very, very close to my heart, and I know we speak about climate change, but you mentioned one of the issues that I have, and that is we do know climate change in general. But our municipalities have a major function, right? And one of the functions is to ensure that houses are not built in vulnerable areas. Climate always will offer, environments will always have vulnerable areas. We do know where the floodline is. But it seems that most of those functions are not being functioned anymore. And then it leads to where you say you as a person and involved with the environment can actually see that houses are being built in areas where it's not going to survive. And to me,
you ask for help, it is actually your municipality, and I do believe that you should leave a complaint with them and say they have to instruct that that won't be. We know it won't happen, and people actually just go where they want to go. But the reality is we cannot blame climate change on when these houses fail, because they were in the first place built in an area where they were not supposed to be built, because our environment, there is, there's something called residential viability where you can actually build and we can't build our environment, it's like that. So this in short, this is to say that there is many functions that our municipalities have to do that they don't adhere to, and we need to start making them responsible to do what they are supposed to do so that we don't have, when a flood comes or when rain comes or something, and these houses fall in or fail because of being built in a flood where they should not have been built. This is just a comment I want to just say.
Okay. You're done, or well?
I can go on forever if you want to know.
I know. please go on. But not here, I expect you to say thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm fine. Thank you. No more comments.
Wonderful. She wants to go on and on.
No, I can't.
It's okay. No, not today.
Not today.
Not today. You want to comment on that?
So, you know, Chair, I think one of the things that is important, and probably why I got on a plane to come here today, is that information asymmetry is a reality. And also the pressures that, remember I said people shift the risk onto us on the ground. You are trying to live as close as you can to where you get to work. You're trying to make a living on a daily basis. And so some of these things, which for others seem obvious, to you are further away from you because you are dealing with basic bread and butter issues. But these basic bread and butter issues are life-threatening. And so if we're not going to have a caring government that's going to care about the fact that life-threatening issues are about to erode the very bit that these people are trying to do by trying to get on, that for me is why, when we talk adaption strategies here, maybe what I'm looking forward to is to see the actual regulations that the department will put in place to be able to say, how are we actually going to make sure that we protect everybody and not just those who can pay the carbon tax? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I don't know what Honorable Matter and Honorable Fosen are saying, because none of them is going to be my, so I can't even hear them myself. I don't expect any of you to hear. They are just looking at each other in the eyes and smiling.
I
think they're being extremely romantic. Thank you very much, Mr. Basha. I think you're making a very important point, overstressing the significance of traditional, the use of traditional means. It's been swept away by climate change and the amount of these floods, etc. I think we've noted the issue of penalties and sanctions, the timelines, and the radar. Very unfortunate that we can only speak about our timeline is a portfolio committee. And so far, our consultation process is very limited with us. We were actually expecting to be done with this process of consultation by end of this month, of May. And then it must still go to the Council of Provinces, must still go to the President and all of that. And if you remember, the previous presentation said we're running out of time, but we're not running out of ideas.
I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So I wish it was within my table of finding on the spot. So that it gets to be implemented. Now, it was yesterday despite all these processes that we have noted all the comments you have made, and welcome your presentation. Thank you very much. Thank you. Really appreciate it. We must explore the possibility of getting other traditional healers so that we get a variety of other ideas on how do you think climate change affects you from the point of view of traditional healers. Where we come from over this weekend to the Southern Cape in George, the koi and the sun came very strong on us, and they spoke about their role on this being as owners of the land. Strong emphasis. They wanted, they were not unequivocal. We are the owners of the land. You're speaking about the bill, you're not speaking to us. And we had to show them that particular clause that speaks about the koi and the sand and all of that. So I think it is linked with what the indigenous traditional leaders role can play in it. But all of this will be put together into a final draft before it becomes a law. We know that the NCOP will also be engaging in legislative consultative processes, which we must recommend to them that they must organize a group of traditional leaders, a group of the core, a group of the same, group of traditional leaders, so that everybody is brought on board to put together this piece of legislation. Thank you very much. And the spread boom came very strong there. And even in the Northern Cape, they spoke about the spread boom. They wanted us to know how the spread boom can help us in the future. Yeah. Okay. We're ready to roll. The department too. Thank you very much, Melanie. Colleagues, can I give you 3 minutes just to
Well, for the first time I hear it too. Did you know? The Honorable
Bata is an Indian. No, Honorable Bata is an Indian.
Did you know?
I know.
When did you know?
When? 3 minutes.
Oh, we're having a conference.
I'm not sure if you're going to be able to do it.
But so you alone level Sangoma. You alone level Sangoma. Because if you were high level Sangoma, you'd have finished them with like a long time.
No,
No problem. If you have a position, it's fine. It's fine. But I don't know it. Yeah, I'm going to protect you. No, it's not an issue. I'm not going to be able to do it. It's not a problem. I'm going to be able to do it. I'm going to be able to do it. In 1997, there was a commission that was in the home of Oram at Hoj, and it was a witchcraft commission.
How many people are there in the country?
I don't know.
Okay.
in a chapter, if I believe, chapter is about four pages of Bible. You know, you put my mother, my sister's own. What can I say? No, no, not the assistant worship, but if you recommend it.
Thank you very much. We are now getting a briefing by the department on anti-poaching strategy on rock lobster.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Let me start by just introducing the reintroducing the colleagues from the department. My name is Sue Middleton. I'm the DDG of Fisheries Management. I'm joined by Mr. Bernard Liederman, who is the Acting Director for Monitoring and Surveillance. And basically his job is to investigate transgressions of right holders. Okay, so he's part of our enforcement component. And then I'm joined by Mr. Odwa Dabula, who is the recently appointed Director Inshore Fisheries Management, responsible for all the inshore or near shore fisheries sectors, including abalone and West Coast rock lobster. He was appointed with effect from January this year, so it's his first attendance at a portfolio committee meeting. So Honourable Paulson, don't scare him away.
Now,
Okay, what happened there?
First thing
I'm not very confident. I don't do this. I don't have the powers.
Okay. Just to, before we move off the first slide, just to explain, I think you might be aware that in the APP, our annual performance plan, as the fisheries branch last year, the target, the key target was to develop an abalone anti-poaching and strategy. This year, in our APP for 23-24, one of the targets is West Coast rock lobster. And the idea there is that we are going to develop a national West Coast rock lobster strategy this year, and a component of that is going to be the West Coast rock lobster enforcement strategy. So the enforcement strategy is a sub-component of the national strategy. The enforcement strategy was approved by myself in March of this year, but we need to consult further on it. So it's a work in progress. In terms of the table of contents, I won't go through everything, but we deal with acronyms, the background, problem statement,
the components of the enforcement strategy, the recommendations of the consultative advisory forum, coming back to the objectives of the enforcement strategy, the goals and objectives of the enforcement strategy, and then number 8 should actually be the progress on the development, not of the poaching reduction strategy, but of the national strategy. Apologies for that.
The national poaching.
Yeah, yeah. And lastly, the next steps, the way forward. I won't go through the acronyms. So if we can go to slide 4, which is the background. Additional information that's not on that slide is that West Coast Rock Lobster, West Coast Rock Lobster fishing rights were allocated in 2015-2016 for a period of 15 years, so they are due to expire in 2032. It's estimated, although we don't have exact figures, that this fishery is a very important fishery in, particularly in the Western Cape, and generates around about 500 million per year and employs about 4,300 people. The fishery has traditionally focused on the West Coast. But our scientists have noted resort ships that started in about the 1990s, whereby the lobster have literally kind of moved down from the Northern Cape into the areas around Hanklip or east of Hanklip. So we've been able to open up 3 new areas in the south since 1990. The fishery consists of the following sectors. Firstly, the commercial offshore sector, and there they fish via the use of traps. When we allocated rights in 2015-2016, the commercial offshore sector rights are allocated to entities or companies, or PTY Limited. Okay. Then we have the inshore commercial sector, who fish via hoop nets. And when we allocated fishing rights in 2015, the nearshore or the inshore sector we allocate to individuals, not to entities. And then we have the interim relief or small scale sector. And when we finalize the allocation of fishing rights in the Western Cape to small scale, West Coast Rock Lobster will be allocated to cooperatives, small scale cooperatives. And our aim is to finalize that by the start of the next West Coast Rock Lobster season, when it opens again in October, because we don't want another round of interim relief. Okay, we want West Coast Rock Lobster to be part of the small-scale cooperative. Then we have the recreational sector. It's quite an important sector in the sense that it does generate tourism and other spin-offs. Essentially, anyone over the age of 12 can purchase a recreational permit on an annual basis, and there they can fish for a number of lobster per day, their size limits, and the distinction with the recreational is that they may not sell their catch. It's for own consumption only. Then, just by way of background, because I know our Honourable Paulson might ask, in the offshore commercial sector, There are 289 right holders or companies that were successfully allocated fishing rights. And with the entities, where rights are allocated to entities, we measure transformation by the black shareholding and the black ownership of the TAC. So in terms of the offshore commercial sector, black shareholding is at 91%. And in terms of black ownership of the TAC, which to us is the best measurement of transformation, that stands at 90.7%. In terms of the inshore commercial, 597 individuals were allocated fishing rights in 2015-16. Of the 597, 53 persons are African, 503 are coloured, no Indians, and 41 white persons. So from those figures you can see that the West Coast Rock Lobster fishery is one of the most transformed in terms of black ownership. The figures again. Okay, so
inshore.
Okay, so 597 individuals. Of that, 53 are African. 53 people of the 597. I didn't work out the percentages, but we can do that. 503 of the 597 are coloured. There are no Indians and 41 white. Offshore, it's 90.7% black ownership of the TAC, and 91% black shareholding in those companies.
In terms of inshore and the percentage of TAC for those populations,
I don't have that figure at hand. I'm going to ask Odwa if you could quickly calculate. So you're asking, inshore?
In terms of a percentage of TAC.
Black ownership of the TAC inshore.
The
you see, we don't, yeah, okay, let's see if we can number crunch that.
Okay, this for the offshore in terms of the percentage of TAC.
Yeah. Because that's how, when you've got entities, we measure it, but it's different with individuals. We tend to just measure African, Indian, coloured, and white.
So what is the TAC for?
That's in tonnage, huh? Can you see what that is in percentage? Okay. Can we come back to you with that figure? We've got it, but it's in tons, so we need to calculate back the percentage of the tonnage. And I'll come to the TAC now.
Okay.
All right, Honourable Paulson, so the percentage TAC allocated, this is inshore. Percentage of the TAC allocated to historically disadvantaged individuals, HDIs, yes, is 93.16%. And the percentage of the TAC allocated to whites is 6.84%. I just thought that we might find those stats of interest. So I'll carry on now with the presentation. Because it's an inshore fishery, the resource is fairly easily accessible. You can just pull out and dive. Sometimes you don't even need oxygen or oxygen tanks. And so the resource is experiencing overfishing and illegal fishing. And the resource obtains good prices on the international markets. In fact, the majority of the product is exported rather than consumed on the local market. And that's one of the things we want to look at in the strategy, is how to promote a local demand as well. Next slide, please. So there's been a steady decline in the resource and in catches since the 1950s and 1960s. And this can be attributed to a number of causes, including too much fish has been fished, so unsustainable harvesting, illegal harvesting, and also environmental challenges. As we have already said, there seems to have been a resource shift down towards the south. We also acknowledge that we're in 2023, and so our monitoring, control, and surveillance efforts could be strengthened through the better use of technology. And the scientists estimate that the resource is currently at 1.3% of pristine level, so the optimal level, which was recorded in 1910. And since then, there's been a steady decline. And where we think a fishery is sustainably fished is if the resource is at 40%, at least 40%. Of the pristine level, and we're well below that. So, in fact, this fishery is in crisis, more so probably than ever more. Better use of technologies, I think Bernie and his team are looking at drones and night vision and other recording devices. I'll come back to that. Another challenge is that the poor fishers, particularly in the small scale sector or the interim relief, are currently being exploited by marketers who are kind of operated middlemen. And the poor fishers pre-sell their catch before the season has even opened. And they are not getting market-related prices for their catch. Now, in terms of the background to the enforcement strategy, which, as I said, would be one arm or leg of the national strategy, the background to that is that in November 21, innocently, in my capacity as the DDG, has the delegation to set the annual TAC each year. That delegation is with me. And in 2021, we cut the TAC, and there was an outcry. So what the minister did was she set up and appointed a consultative advisory forum. It was a committee of experts and scientists, and they were asked to advise on the future of the West Coast Rock Lobster fishery.
the forum was asked to take presentations and representations from stakeholders in the methodology that the department uses to set the TAC. They were also asked to review the appropriateness of the proportional cuts within the various fisheries, so the cut in the TAC. And just by way of background, I think it was in about 2015, my predecessor did not follow the scientific advice and set the TAC above the scientific recommendation, and the department was taken to court by the WWF, and we lost that case. So as a delegated authority, when you're setting the TAC, your hands are pretty tied by the scientific recommendation. So part of the brief, the CAP was asked to look at the methodology that we use to set the TAC. The minister also requested that we need to look at whether cutting the TAC is in the interest of the fishery or not, in terms of the sustainability of the fishery. And also to advise on appropriate ways in which fishing communities and fishers themselves can assist the department in co-managing the resource. In other words, if you are a right holder and you have a vested interest in protecting the sustainability of the fishery and to stop poaching, let's find ways of partnering with those right holders to protect their own resource. The CAF met from November 21, December, January. They had a total of 9 meetings amounting to 42 hours, and they took various there were observers in the meeting from small scale and from rights holders and from the industry, and all of them made various presentations to the CAF. And the CAF came up with 5 cross-cutting recommendations, and that's where we are at the moment. As the department and the fisheries branch, we're busy trying to implement those 5 key recommendations made by the CAF. So the next slide, page 7, takes us through, and I'm sorry the margin seems to have cut off there a little bit, but I think you could still make up the numbers. Apologies for that. So the CAF made 5 recommendations on how to better manage and the resource and possible improvements. The first one was for us as the department to co-develop and implement a West Coast rock lobster poaching reduction strategy. So that strategy the department has developed with some consultation. It was approved in March 23, but we do think that we need to now consult extensively on that strategy. It's a work in progress, and we think by consultations we can enhance and improve the strategy and get buy-in. So the poaching reduction strategy will be one component of the national strategy. The second recommendation of the CAF was for us to conduct an integrated socioeconomic study that needs to inform the anti-poaching strategy as well. So where we are at the moment is that we're developing the terms of reference for the study, which we'll put out to tender. We are similar to what we did with the abalone. We want to have a big multi-stakeholder workshop and conference towards the end of the year. And the socioeconomic study and the results thereof will be presented at this workshop to be taken forward. The third recommendation was to implement a co-management approach to the management of the fishery, particularly involving the small-scale sector, and to immediately pilot a more participatory approach. What we've done there is we've held a meeting with the West Coast Rock Lobster Industry Association to discuss, because at the moment they just represent the commercial sector, we wanted to discuss with them how they could partner more with the small scale sector. They, at that meeting, also raised with us, they want to partner with us and pilot a West Coast Rock Lobster traceability project, where we can trace who caught the fish, where, and where it was processed, and where it was exported. And more the international market is demanding such certification because they want confidence and surety that they are not purchasing illegal products. And we're talking there about a partnership with the WWF on looking at the traceability study. We've also invited the small scale sector to be part of our scientific and management working group. And of particular importance for small scale would be representation, not on an observer status, but proper representation or membership of the working group, and in particular with West Coast Rock Lobster, abalone and lionfish. Next slide, please. Just to mention the recommendation is that we need to set up co-management structures in the small scale fishery. That we will do as soon as the Western Cape rights have been allocated. Then we'll set up co-management structures in all of the four coastal provinces. The fourth recommendation was that we needed to work with WWF and stakeholders on a fishery improvement program. I've already mentioned the traceability project. And the improvement program will be another leg of the national strategy. The fifth recommendation is that the fishing communities need to receive fair benefits along the entire value chain. And this will require capacity building and mechanisms to support them, and the immediate priority has the identification of the need to regulate the marketers. But really what we need to do is we need to cut out the marketers and the middlemen so that the small-scale fishers themselves control the entire value chain, including the processing and the marketing, because they've been exploited at the moment. So that was the fifth recommendation. As I've already mentioned, what we've done is that we've escalated the development of the strategy into our APP. So you will be measuring us this year in terms of our progress made against that target. And as I've said, we are looking at working towards a stakeholder workshop where we will refine and develop the strategy with all its components. And it would be wonderful if some members of the portfolio committee were able to attend that workshop. Okay. We're looking towards the end of the year, kind of October, November, December, early December. Sometime around that, although we are mindful that the season will have started and when people are fishing. So yeah, we'll have to look at that. Then in terms of the poaching reduction strategy, there are six strategic goals in that strategy. This is the strategy that has been approved, but that we do want to treat it as a working, living document, and that we want to consult further on it. But just very quickly, the goals are to develop a centralized monitoring, control, and surveillance transgression register, which records real-time transgression, both at land and at sea, and which includes right holders, exemption holders, fish processing establishments, and the exporters. And actually, I think the big weakness in this chain is at the exporter. And we want to integrate that information into our, what we call the marine administration system, our in-house system, IT system. The second goal is the implementation of technology in terms of improving monitoring, control, and surveillance, and co-management practices to support traceability. I've already mentioned there that we're looking at drones and other smart technologies. We're also appointing catch data monitors through the Working for Fisheries program, who will be recording what is landed at landing sites, and there we want to give them smartphones so that they can punch in the data and it's real time. There's no lag at all. The third goal, as we've already said, is to put in place a system to regulate marketers, and there we need more discussion, but we're thinking of a system whereby marketers have to be recognized by the department, and in terms of that recognition, they've got to adhere to certain behaviors and practices. But that's very much a work in progress. We need to tighten that one up. The fourth goal is obviously cooperation with enforcement partners through Operation Takisa, and in particular the what is called the operational sub-task team, where we want monthly deployments and we want closer monitoring of exports from our major ports, particularly Cape Town International and OR Tambo, but also some of the harbors. And there we would obviously need to cooperate with SARS and SAT, and we want real-time live data. The fifth strategic objective is to create awareness to support voluntary measures and traceability and co-management of the resource. And really, we want the right holders and the community to be beneficiaries of the product to manage the resource themselves. The sixth objective is capacity building, especially for small scale, and that will be an ongoing process. Then lastly, in terms of progress, as we said, the anti-poaching or the enforcement strategy has been developed and approved. The recommendations of the CAF were incorporated into that enforcement strategy. Bernie and his team have been very active on the ground. They've already brought two since the approval and the finalization of the CAP recommendations. They've brought criminal cases against two marketers who were caught illegally exporting 14 tons of lobster. And there are some more criminal cases that are in the pipeline. Next step, as I've already said, is to work towards a stakeholder engagement workshop in order to achieve co-ownership of all the strategies. We want to make sure that we do implement the CAF recommendation. We need to set up the co-management structure. We need to regulate marketing, and we need to build our own capacity in-house to better monitor and enforce the issue. And with that, I thank you.
That last slide does not appear on our copy. All of us. The last one.
Yeah, we'll make copies.
Okay, honorable members, let's engage the presentation on the anti-poaching strategy. Honorable Gordon, you are told not to scare someone. Please don't scare people. And then you will be followed by Honorable Weber, then Honorable Bai. Then Honorable Mark, and then Honorable
Whatever Honorable Lamini, he spoke about fisheries, but I knew, when I listened to you, I knew. This guy doesn't know a fishing rod. I love the new brother.
Thank you very much, Ms. Middleton. And I understand that this is a high value species and it has great potential. But I'm also concerned that in terms of managing the resource, whether the cause of the low levels is poaching, or in the fact that there are environmental factors. I know there's been red tide, for example, and I see also what they do now is try and rescue the crayfish that walk out and return them. And so I would like to know what are we doing, because there are early warning systems. But I don't mean like a current system. We've got these guys in the boat and we go and take measurements of oxygen level. I remember many years ago when I was at CPUT, we did a colleague of mine did a presentation of a floating buoy that measured and sent real-time data of the oxygen level. So that solution is still available, by the way. So what we can do about the the other thing is given the fact that that it's such a high value species, and that we are really doing very poorly in terms of aquaculture, especially these high value species are good candidates for aquaculture. They've got the time to maturity is less than other fish species. What are the plans, or are there plans to assume aquaculture? Because I know on the West Coast we bring mussel extensively. There are some issues in terms of payment for rental to transient, which makes it almost impossible. So, but it's outside of this, but because I just think I think the fact that you've got such a broad spread of shareholders and participants, it reduces the number one, it increases monitoring for poachers, right? And I also wouldn't want people's livelihoods to be threatened by people who are not accredited or to participate. Right? So what was my question? But in terms of the training of these people to deal with this, of those who legitimate participants to deal with poaching or anything to that effect. And because I didn't know there are syndicates that operate in this area, that the participants, they are told that they can't sell their cats to anyone else but to them. It's actually very serious. So what other protection do we offer these participants other than just monitoring approaches? What about those syndicates that operate in these schools? And in fact, so then men, they give these people money even beforehand, and like, you know, so they have to bring their cats to them, and you know, they're left with nothing. And that's when those very same people go to approach. So what other protection measures are in place for those who participate legally in harvesting crop stuff? And then also, why is West Coast rock lobster treated differently from the South Coast? You know, the South Coast has an even higher rate and low number of participation. Why is it treated differently?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jay.
Sure. Honorable Weber?
Sorry, I don't want you interrupting, but I do want to be heard. No to you, I know you guys have to speak, so I'm willing to wait. My questions are very basic. I think with managing the resources, and like you say, and you've said that this is really a problem, the number of it, and originally my first thing was, why don't we just stop it until, you know, there are things left, and I got the answer. But then, if you cut half of the limit to people, it is also half the income of people, which is also a problem. So, I'm always someone who's trying to look for the solutions which are not so much into the fisheries that the research do. So forgive me if I step on toes or are being very uninformed. But when we come to the aquaculture of the lobster, my colleague just said to me it's a very complicated and probably expensive thing. Is there a way where we can increase this lobster privately without the poaching and everything and then reintroduce into the sea or something like that? Or in the sea have dams or areas limited of where we can actually grow these lobsters and then reintroduce or just to start stocking and making sure that, you know, all these lobsters are not just and I know that costs money, but to me that might be one, because I don't see how we're going to cut it, but you have to do something. I mean, otherwise there's none left, which is also a problem. Then my question to this, I'm very happy to see you have on the offshore and inshore limits and everything, but with recreational, I do know that brings people in and it's tourism. I am 100% sure I won't go on holiday just to catch one lobster for my family. I'm not against this, but you say you buy a permit for a year and then there's a daily limit. What is a daily limit? Is it for a year, every day, daily limit, or is it just for that once off? Okay, it is four. So I don't know how many people come back. Isn't that something you can just limit to one? I understand that the procedure and everything and the fun of it, but it's more the fun than the actual lobster that this is about. But to me, to have something like this going well, that is really so endangered at this stage, and we don't want them, we want to provide for people more. So that is one of the things that I was just thinking of. And then my last thing is, my last question is, everything else does make sense. You're in a very difficult situation. As you said, you did touch to back on the two commercial people.
that were captured, what would a sentence like that be, and would that be found guilty? And can a sentence maybe include not just the final or jail sentence, but maybe a 5-year rehabilitation period before they can restart being active again in this? And I do think that is something we need to bring in with these people. But in any case, that's my take. Thank you.
Marvin Bryan.
Thanks very much. Can I just quickly check, has the meeting been recorded, this meeting? Okay, there we go. Okay, cool. Just check. Because I was wondering whether I still have my mics on and how we were actually going to take the minutes and ensure that everything was taken into consideration. Just quickly, just in terms of my colleague's point with recreation and fishing.
Please don't raise issues of MLA things. You know nothing about law.
Just in terms of recreational fishing, I mean, the whole rationale behind it is don't get tagged out 4 crabs every day throughout the year. It's a very, very limited time window where you actually are able to fish recreationally. A lot of recreational fishing are quite upset about this because it really makes getting a fishing license pretty futile for crayfish in most instances, because you have such a limited period of time when you can actually make use of it. Ms. Middleton, thank you very much for the presentation. A couple of points. The one is, you have mentioned that the enforcement change was approved by you in March, and there is now a need to do further consultation. Who is that consultation going to be with? Do you have any idea how long that's going to take? Because obviously the enforcement strategy is very important for us. Taking into consideration what you already mentioned around stocks of crayfish and the criminality that's associated with the poaching industry, and things like that that's on drugs and all sorts of other legal activity that's taking place in the community. We do find that some of the areas where we have high levels of poaching industry already in place, such as South Bay, we know that there are established poaching operations, and what tends to happen is the bites that are taking place, which are fantastic, very, very welcome, aren't necessarily taking place at the source, so to speak. I'm just wondering whether or not that is going to be factored into the enforcement plan to look at the centres of operations where the majority of this poaching is emanating from, in terms of the English Kingdom and those people. I know it's a similar situation up the coast in Huntsford and Claymont and Worcester and things like that. Just going back to recreational fishing, I understand that there was at one stage a recreational fishing working group. Is that still meeting, and are they being consulted in the process? I also understand that there was a piece of research undertaken on recreational fishing in the Western Cape in 2012, around about then, and that made a certain number of findings around the impact of recreational fishing on the local economy, particular issues that have been mentioned when it comes to tourism. So people who would traditionally go away to a coastal community, I know you said you wouldn't go there just to catch one crayfish, but I think there are people who do tend to go to certain parts of the Cape coastline, you know, camp and then go and do some recreational fishing while they're there, and particularly areas where there used to be a lot of recreational crayfishing taking place. That has been found in that report. I think it was called the intensive report, and was put together by the intensive research group, and that has a number of findings. So just whether or not those have been included in this overall strategy that's been presented as well. Then in terms of the actual enforcement strategy here, you did mention the idea of drones and night vision. That's all fantastic. Just wanting to find out if the plan to work in terms of Akita and all of that, and working with the staffs, is going to include working with local law enforcement as well. I know in Cape Town in particular, there's a very active local law enforcement unit as well, which is helping and they also have access to some of these drones, and there might be a potential consideration there. And then just two final points. The first one is, you mentioned that the majority of the product is exported. Does that apply to the poached crayfish as well? And how is that being facilitated in terms of export? And the last one was just in terms of the need to cut off the market. I suppose we have to recognize the fact that the market is there filling the space at present. So a lot of it has got to do with developing that industry over time as well. You also don't want to find out that by taking away the market too quickly, you can compete with the swimming industry for those smaller caps as well. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Brian. Honourable Mbato.
Thank you, Chair.
No,
thank you, Sue. I think you explained the progress and KC rate of progress. But the only thing I think there is a matter of time. You didn't give us the statistics on the many people that we see and the determinants. That's the only thing I think at least we know how this thing has been official distributed. But I'm only worried that the high number of colors here.
That's very racist. And this is typically what the ANC has become, a very racist organization. You could be a party of non-racism, but this one comes and says that I'm happy because there are a number of colors. That's nonsense.
Okay, let's proceed.
Thank you, Chair, for that.
You wish to.
It is our team, our good friend. The other issue, still, I know it's good that the importation and exportation, but how do we empower? I know exposition and importation is very tricky and difficult if you are not trained on it. That's where you might find that our people can export or import. And then on the operation package, I'm happy that it has improved, and I've noticed that on the first one, on page 10, the first one, I've seen there's a lot of recovery of the income of golden lobsters through the police and the port of entry of both of them, the airport and the other one. So there's a lot of improvement on that. But in short, is it the number of illegal animals lobsters is decreasing or is increasing? Does it show an impact that you as the department you are doing in the future with the task force on that? And what are the actual penalties to those people who are illegal animals lobsters in the future?
Thank you. Honorable Kumi.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you too, for the presentation and the team. We certainly appreciate the figures that you gave us that in case that we are on the track in terms of the shareholders and the companies and the offshore and the inshore commercial surplus on the small scale, there's a cooperative. One would like to get more information on the successfulness of those cooperatives when it comes to them being given their terms, fishery permits, and are they able to grow? Because I'm sure when we project, we need to also be able to say, from being a small-scale fishery or a cooperative, who are able to grow to get to the offshore level. The second one, Honorable Chair, is the issue of the resources the on page for where the head resource obtains good prices on an international market. In terms of the study countries, which countries are in that export level, at higher level? Are they inland countries or the coastal countries? I'm interested in that one because it will also lead us to identify maybe that is approaching and those marketers when it comes to the inland countries. Because, if it's the coastal countries, then you'll understand that yes, they've got access to the coast. But if it's inland, then we need to look at it more strategically. And I appreciate the fact that the technology that is now being implemented is good, and I'm sure it's going to give us good results. The fishing rights that you spoke about, you said they were given for 15 years. And currently, we are developing, we are having an anti-poaching strategy, which is an indication that this is a vulnerable species. Do we have a plan of how, I know Honorable Weber just mentioned this one, how can we ensure that we preserve, we have a strategy on preservation of this particular species, the West Coast rock lobster, so that we don't talk about going away, I mean diminishing in the process, whilst we have those fishing rights up to 2032, next? So which is a long time, and do we have a strategy dealing with that matter. In terms of when you get to the road, to the strategy itself, the goal one, which also looks at the value chain, and we say in the value chain, the weakest is the exporters. the weakest is the exporters, and you intend getting those that have the fishing rights to that very chain up to the exporters level. Do we have a working relationship with the Department of Trade and Industry in terms of informing this one, so that we can have I'm looking at that one on page 4, even the small scale or the cooperatives, so that they can be given that opportunity of being exporters, so that they can go through that very chain and get to that level of empowerment, because it that talks to the empowerment. Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Kikun. So let's start with the national strategy. We have elevated it into the APP before we approved it recently. I saw it somewhere. Am I right or am I right?
No, we want to. We've approved the anti-poaching strategy or the enforcement strategy, but before, which will become one component of the bigger national strategy, which we still still under development.
Okay. The national strategy, the anti-poaching strategy. And that's on the 2023-2024
season. You're on the call. I think so. The target for 2023-24 is a draft national West Coast rock lobster strategy.
Yeah.
The target for last year was a West Coast rock lobster anti-poaching strategy.
You did not meet that?
We did.
You did?
Yeah.
So, by implication, you are going to meet this one? Or you
We need a draft.
Okay. That's fine. But I just wanted to get that out of the record. We constantly speak about the West Coast rock lobster. Does that suggest that the West Coast is most vulnerable? What is happening in the overbed? What is happening in the South Coast? Are we experiencing similar poaching areas or percentages, for lack of a better word? I think that it will help us to get that understanding. This rock lobster strategy enforcement strategy that has been developed. You're saying to us you have consulted a number of stakeholders and it will be a further consult those workshops. No, you say that we don't live in South Africa. Where do these workshops happen? I don't know. I've never even seen any of this in a newspaper for you. Or you have your own people that you invite in corners. where do you consult? If, for example, we were to go on a into a particular province, the whole country would know that we are going to the Northern Cape to do climate change public consultative process and so on. I'm interested in how do you invite your own stakeholders and how many of you do you get just 10 people in a corner and say, hey, chief, sign the register. I'm just checking. I'm more like Honorable Weber, we're not very coastal, we are on a lighter side. One more thing, Ms. Middleton, I'm getting a sense that the future of rock lobster is really in trouble, and that in 2021, fortunately, all of us were there. The minister assigned a special project of consultative advice and forum to advise on the future of this business. And they made recommendations. Who was it? Did you know them then? Were they paid? Or they were just doing it out of credit. But lastly, the deployment of technology I think you spoke about drones. Do you have drones underwater, or you are going to deploy them somewhere over the sea? I'm just worried what's going to happen there. You want to take us through? Sure. Is it okay?
No. I was scratching my head.
Okay. Thank you, honourable members, for the question. I'll start, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Lederman to come in with the aspects around the anti poaching strategy and the use of technologies and so on. Any questions that I don't cover? Audra, if you'd like to talk about South Coast and East Coast, you can come in at the end. So let me start with Honourable Paul Fink in the order that the questions were asked. You were talking about the combination, and I want to agree with you. I think the decline in the status of the resource, as well as the decline in the number of catches, is a combination of factors. And environmental factors do play a role. It's not only overfishing and illegal fishing. There are indeed environmental factors. In fact, the right holders complain often that they're unable to catch their full quota, and they cite a number of problems, including weather conditions and poor visibility and so on and so on. So I think it's not just one thing. It's a combination of things that are contributing to this, but there's no doubt that illegal fishing is a big part of it, and that we do need to get that under control. It takes a slightly different character to abalone. At this stage, it's not as nasty as the abalone syndicate crimes, but I think it's getting there. Honourable Fulton, you spoke about early warning systems. Especially in terms of detecting oxygen levels and forecasting the algae blooms and so on. Yes, we are able to monitor, and we do have early warning systems. And the most common occurrence of algae blooms and lobster walkouts is around the Eland Bay area, because of the geography of that particular bay, and the lobsters and the blooms get trapped in the bay when there's an onshore or southeaster wind. So at the best, the early warning systems enable us to get teams on the ground in readiness for the lobster. We can't prevent the lobster walkout or even keep the algae blooms away. And unfortunately, it's regarded as a natural phenomenon, that or an act of God, that is really not under our control. And it happens, sometimes it happens annually, and if it is happening, it's counted around the Easter period. So yes, the early warning systems are there, but what it enables us to do together with the local and the district municipality and communities is to have people ready to catch the lobster and put them immediately into tanks so that we can put them back into the water. And the longer we wait and unable to respond, the more fatalities there are. And also then health threats to communities, because they pick up the dead lobster and they've been baking in the sun, and then they become a health risk. Again, colleagues, you're welcome to add. I totally agree with you that the answer to anti-poaching strategies is real-time data. In terms of aquaculture, and I think Honourable Weber, you also asked about aquaculture, I'm not a scientist, but not a biologist, but my aquaculture colleagues tell me that lobster does not do well as a bred species in tanks. They tend to eat one another, they're cannibals, and they don't grow very well in tanks. For at the moment, as the department, it's not a species that we think we can grow viably in a farmed condition. We're looking more at the abalone, at the oysters, the mussels, fin fish. We've got a project on scallops. So it tends to be the sedentary species or the slow-moving species or fish, a fin fish that can be grown in tanks. I don't know, and I think that we would ask the scientists to look at whether there's stock enhancement strategies that we can use similar to abalone where we do seeding and so on. But I think the problem with the lobster is that the females carry the berries on their bodies. It's different to other fish species. But other, please comment, you're more of a scientist than you are than I am. Bernie, I don't know if you could take the question from Honourable Paulson about how we can involve communities in the protection of the resource while not exposing them to threats and dangers. That's your area of expertise. Honourable Weaver, as I've responded about aquaculture, I totally agree with you that if there was a choice, I would cut the recreational fishery, but I'm told it would cause a national outcry and that I'm not that brave. apparently, although as Honourable Grant says, it's a very small window when they're allowed to catch it, really around Christmas and Easter, basically. But they're not allowed to sell; they're only allowed for own consumption. But it's considered a real part or a real right of any South African to get their own education. So we're told that the political outfall of closing down the recreational fishery would be huge. I'm not the politician.
It's a lobster that I understand
or nothing quite as in terms, I think, of the, you asked the question about fines. Bernie, you can correct me here, but in terms of the one regulation 3, government notice 19205, the maximum in terms of the regs, the maximum of fine is 800,000 or 2 years imprisonment if found guilty. And in terms of the act itself, the penalty is 2 million or 5 years. So we tend to use the act more than the regs because the penalties are harsher, but still there's a feeling that they, for big companies, maybe the little guys would struggle to pay 2 million, but a big company that does it. So, I think it's one of the things we want to look at when we review the MLRA, which is another big project, is to look at harsher fines and penalties.
Yes, Matthew, I just want to add to that, maybe just a few minutes from you. When you do revise that maybe we must get to a second and a third offence, and the third offence is that they cannot ever do that. You know,
incremental, yeah.
So that basically there's two.
Honourable Bryant, we've commented on the recreational fishery. Bernie, if you'll deal with the poaching operations and trying to target the centers of poaching and the technology and whether we use local enforcement in our ops and deployments. To my knowledge, the majority of the exported product is to the east, China, and Asian countries, and in particular live lobster. And it is often exported as part of a legal consignment for under the same export permit. So the issuing of export permits is something that we need to look at. You're quite correct that if poorer communities or small scale are to control the value chain and the marketing, it can only happen with the support of governments through capacity building initiatives. Honourable Mbata, you asked me about women, youth and disabled, and military veterans. I don't think we've got stats for military vets or disabled. Well, I don't have them on hand. I'll check when I get back to the office and submit to you. But in terms of women, male and females in the nearshore sector, there are 408 men and 189 women and 5 youth. It's an aged issue in terms of the participants. Okay, offshore, I don't have those figures because as we say, we measure shareholders. But we can look at trying to get you, and I'll submit that to you in writing, female shareholders in the offshore sector. The Honourable Mbata is correct that we are intersecting poached abalone, and there are more incidences of us confiscating and fining people. But unfortunately with lobster, that's too late. So a measure of success is not the number of confiscations or operations where we find product. The measure of success, which is hard to measure, is to keep the fish in the sea in the first place. Honourable Nkulu, you mentioned cooperatives. Just to say that in terms of the small scale fisheries policy, we allocate fishing rights to small scale cooperatives, which we've done in the Northern Cape, the Eastern Cape and KZN. Western Cape is, we've just allocated, but the appeals process hasn't been finalized. In terms of the policy, after a 2-year period of after which the rights have been allocated to primary cooperatives, we then, our next task is to set up secondary cooperatives, which become your processing and marketing mechanisms. So a number of primary cooperatives in an area will belong to secondary cooperatives. And the idea is that those secondary cooperatives are trained up to become your business avenues, your processing and your marketing and your export. So we are about to start that in the other 3 coastal provinces. The Northern Cape rights were allocated first, so their 3 years is up and we can now set up the secondary cooperatives. And their training will be a big focus. Bernie, I don't know if you want to comment on SADC countries. and I don't know if it's similar to Avalon, where the major illegal export of abalone is going through Tanzania, I think. But anyway, you can comment on that one. I take the point about the DTI. We at the moment have a MOU with the Department of Small Business Development, but I think there is room for a similar arrangement with the DTI and other government departments. The chair's not here, but she asked where workshops happen. So the Avalon workshop was, we invited representatives of all the stakeholders to one central venue. We worked with NGOs who assisted in the transport and the accommodation, and we were in Stellenbosch for a week. But in terms of other consultations, we tend to do what we call roadshows. We go out to communities rather than bringing communities to us, because we're mindful that communities don't have the financial means to attend workshops, so we tend to go out to them. The Honourable Chair asked, who are the cats? And were they paid? If I remember correctly, it was a five-person appointment, and most of them were scientists, but some were representing the academic. So the chair was somebody from Stanby who had been part of the department before. Then there were two international scientists, one scientist from Rhodes University, and a representative of communities. And then a small scale were there, as well as the West Coast Rock Lobster Industry Association, the head observer status. Our act allows for the payment of CAF members, and the rate is set in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. Unlike the rest of the department who struggle to pay, we do have a legal mechanism to pay them. There's quite a technical questionnaire that we have to fill in terms of the level of what their responsibilities will be, and that helps determine the rate level. Okay. We'll talk about technology underwater. So with your permission, if I could hand over to Mr. Liederman, just to mop up the questions on enforcement.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Thank you for the honour and the privilege to be able to respond to some of the questions. The DDG outlined in the last comments the consultative advisory forum engagement. And from an enforcement perspective, we've always focused, if I can mention it, at the point of the illegal operations, where it actually starts. And the reason why we're doing that, or why we're still doing that, is mainly from a preventative perspective. But what came out very strongly, and Chairperson and members, allow me just to explain, and it emanated from these consultative advisory forum engagements, where as the DDG said, there were various members. It was well represented, and we as enforcement officials had to also present at the CAF engagements. But what came out very strongly through the 42 hours was that was the issue about the marketers and the members or community members not getting the full benefits of the resource. This resource sells for 900 rand and over per kilogram at the on international market. Some of the members, it was shocking to see what the community members actually received. And what we've done, we not neglecting any other area of focus in terms of enforcement. We started looking at the marketers. Now the marketers, they not righteous. Marketers, the marketer can either be a marketer or a marketer and an exporter. Now, what came up in terms of the recommendations? There was a lot, although it's a recommendation fund, a lot of emphasis was on these, we need to look at these marketers. And this was an outcry from the community members. And the CAF was basically a mouthpiece in that regard. So what we've done is, now the marketer is no rights holder, but he's a permit holder. A permit is issued to him, they sign a contract with a rights holder to say, you'll deliver your lobster to me. Now, we issue to that marketer or exporter both an export permit. Now this is where we started focusing and it led us on to the honorable members the question, what service do we do to we provide to communities and households? Now we looked at the specific marketers and the marketer, he needs to export. Now what they do is, we will provide an export permit for a specific quantum, say for example 5 tons, which amounts to the amount of the rights holders who signed with a specific marketer. Now when they export, they will never export just the 5 tons, they will export a portion of it. And this is where they abuse the system. Because now what they do is, they buy or purchase illegally gained lobster that was either caught at night or by means of any other means, but caught illegally, and they would take that and they would export those under that same permit. The reason being, our officials, and that is why the DDG mentioned that we through Pakisa partner with all the relevant partners, so because we cannot have a 24/7 presence, say for example at Cape Town International Airport. Now we found, now each marketer needs to notify, I'm exporting today 500 kilos. That 500 kilos get deducted from his quantum. Now we found that, and he needs to notify. Now we found out and we did reactive verification and investigations, and we found that some of them, and intentionally and knowingly, they export without notification. And you can see once the permit allocation is reached, they stop notifying. So in other words, they're doing it intentionally. There's intention behind it, and we found, and that's just a brief explanation, we've arrested two, and hopefully, not hopefully, there will definitely be a lot of arrests in that regard. So instead of just focusing 90% of our enforcement efforts along the coast, we're now looking at the point of export. Now, so that is basically the service we're doing, and the communities and the rights holders. It's the first time that we've done this extensive work, and it's mainly emanating from the CAF region. In terms of the question from Honorable Brian, the centers of the operations, yes, we focus on this. From the West Coast right down to the Overberg, there are cases external to the ones that I've just mentioned, which involves government officials, which involves commercial operators, that's currently now before the DPP for consideration for prosecution. We've taken serious action in terms of both in the Overberg and the West Coast, where we've got cases running, focusing specifically on the centers of the illegal operations in here. Through the Pakisa structures, we work very close with the local municipalities within the Overberg and the center of or the city of Cape Town as well. In terms of the, if you just allow me, DDG, in terms of the recreational fishing, the DDG mentioned that
recreational fishing. Recreational fishing, you're not allowed to sell your catch. Now we've got about 12 days for a recreational fisherman, which can catch within a season, which is roughly between, say, November, December, until the Easter weekend. Now, in the past, the West Coast rock lobster recreational season used to extend from November, December, right down till June, every day. Now, what would happen, and we that have been here for many years, you know, we that time when it was like that it wasn't actually a recreational season, in my opinion, because people were selling the lobster, because they could catch the four every day, if they don't get inspected, they go catch another four. So they would catch and they would sell, and I think that might have been, it's just a force, might have been the to the detriment of the status of the resource. Now the season is only 12 days long, and you can catch four. And believe me, the people who are still buying a firm today, they're the true recreational fishermen, because you have to drive 40 kilometers to the sea, go dive or go out with your little boat and only catch four. And with four you can feed, say, up to 16 people if you like to make a nice meal. So that's the true recreation. So I think we're on the right track in terms of that, you know, and just to give you an idea, it shouldn't be like it was in the past, a 6 months every day season. In terms of the drones, we're looking at the drones and applying technology, both in the form of drones, but mainly aerial drones. We've looked at the unmanned underwater vehicle as well, but that's not as effective as your eye in the sky, basically. So it's mainly an aerial platform, aerial drone. We've used light aircraft in the past, but the drone technology is being used by enforcement worldwide, and I think that's the way to go in terms of drones. We're also looking at technology, like the DDG mentioned, to incorporate our system with a marine administrative system. So, for example, when a commercial landing takes place in Doornbaugh in the West Coast, that we know almost real time of that landing, it is captured, say, for example, at the office in Portland. So, technology that will assist in that regard as well. In terms of the SARIC matters, it's mainly applicable to abalone, but West Coast rock lobster, it's mainly exported in its live state, so they'll take the quickest and shortest route, mainly in its live state. When it gets in a frozen form, it gets exported mainly to the United States, and when it gets sent to the United States, it's mainly in the tail form only, because it looks like the U.S. market only wants the meat. They don't want to battle to get a little meat out of the legs and stuff. But that point made, the DDG said, mention about the fines. And the most significant case in the early 2000s in terms of West Coast rock lobster was in excess of, here in South Africa, was in excess of 40 million rand, and that's still the record in terms of fines, way above what is stipulated in the Act. But the reason why we could get that was because we could couple our legislation, which is the Marine Living Resources Act, with other legislation, complementary legislation, which is, for example, the prevention of organized crime, and if you put the MRA and you can prove organized crime, then you can augment the impact of the funds. So, did you think that?
Thanks, the honorable chair and honorable members. There was a question on what are we doing with the South Coast rock lobster and East Coast rock lobster. South Coast rock lobster is also being managed like West Coast rock lobster. They are allocated and they are running in 2037. But the reasons why South Coast rock lobster is not
has dominated West Coast reports is capital intensive. One is a bigger business than coal, and it is offshore to get it. And the other driver, like I met, who is school for experts in Fusano politics, is the issue of market. So if there is a market or let's say consumer, they prefer West Coast of lobster over other lobsters. So those who are involved in poaching, they will target that this is needed by the consumer, and consumers are willing to pay a price for it. But what happens in economies is that if lobster decreases to very low level, it is not in the getting, the consumers will change their taste, they can change, they will opt for others. You may find a chance of investing on high or bigger vessels to go offshore to get some cost of lobster. But this cost of lobster is more in the Eastern Cape and is currently being allocated by international chemicals and is earmarked for small scale fishers. So it will form part of the basket of species for small scale fishers. But also currently is this coastal lobster is also sold locally in those restaurants. If you go to the city, in one of the restaurants, you will find a menu with this coastal lobster. Yes, they do export, but it's not exported as West Coast lobster. And on another question, whether we are working with DGI, yes, we do work with DGI, because if the consignment is going, there will be people from customs to do their own paperwork because of our own people. We also work with the NRCS, which is National Regulatory for Cobalt Transportation. So they issue certification of the product to certify whether it is fit for human consumption. And they also adhere to international law in terms of issuing their certification. So another question was on preservation of lobster, what things that we are doing to preserve lobster. In terms of the determination of the TAC, in terms of the Act, so when that is done, it will take into consideration the issue of sustainability. Hence the TAC is revisited to certain levels. And when the levels are low, the fishery contract is going to start to allow it to grow to certain levels where it is, of course,
I think there are follow-ups. Let's just take follow-ups in the last round and the close so that we can go to the intake. Honorable Weber?
Let me shine my fossil fuel attitude here. No, it's a question I actually
prefer. You'll be followed by Honorable Brian. Is there any line? And then Honorable Kundu will be the last.
I just want to ask, you mentioned that the lobster moves from the south now down to the western Cape. And that assume it's from the northern Cape down there. Does that mean there is no one left there? Or does it mean the same number still remains there, but there's just the ship going down? So does that decrease the number in the northern Cape? Or do you understand what I'm trying to find, basically?
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Mr. Middleton. Just a couple of points that just to follow up on that weren't answered. The first one, just coming back to recreational fishing first, and you mentioned the potential political fallout. I mean, I would be one of the people with it all signed, standing outside if there was a decision taken to cancel recreational fishing. As somebody who's grown up on the coast and engaged in recreational fishing myself, I think a lot of people really value that. It's part of the culture for a lot of people on the coast. And we spoke about the true recreational fishermen. I mean, I think that window, many people actually complain it's a little bit too short. Some guys have actually had to sell their boats, and that's because it's not really worthwhile keeping it for 12 days, all the rings and the equipment. And so we would advocate to make it a little bit longer. And it's important that people have access to that. You know, you spoke about how expensive crimp is, 900 grams per kilo, being sold elsewhere. somebody's going to be able to enjoy a crepe on their table, even for middle class people, it's expensive to apply. Just coming back to that research project of recreational fishing, an intense research paper, just more about that, whether or not that's being factored in, and those comments around the impact of scaling back on recreational fishing on coastal communities and tourism, etc. And then just last two, and then also just in terms of that recreational fishing working group and whether or not they were part and whether that still exists and meets. And then the last one is, who is the outstanding consultation still going to be done with?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the responses. I want to go back to that question on the SADC countries, that in terms of exporting, take for instance us as South Africa, who are a coastal country, you have other countries like Zambia who are inland countries. In terms of the rate of exporting these species, where are we? Is there an inland country that is exporting more than the coastal countries? Have we done that study? If we haven't done that study, can we do that? Because it's going to lead us to where the challenge is in terms of the poaching of the illegal poaching of this vulnerable species. The second follow-up, Honourable Chair, is on Ms. Middleton said that there's a policy of taking the primary cooperatives in 2 years' time and migrate them to the secondary cooperative. Can we get the statistics? Or is it a new policy? If it's a new policy, then we can monitor it. But if it's an old policy, do we have the statistics of these small-scale fisheries, these cooperatives, saying in years or so we're able to take so many cooperatives to the next stage, and where are they as it is now? Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Middleton?
Okay. Quickly. Mr. Mdudu, Ottawa will respond on the recreational fishery, but Honourable Bryant, in terms of your question about whether there is a working group, I think it's one of our objectives this year. The recreational sector is not organised. There's no one coherent industrial body. They're like a loose conglomerate of individuals, so it's very difficult to engage with them. But one of our priorities this year is to set up a recreational indaba, where we want to engage with the recreational sector on a number of issues. But Adwa, you can come in. I think that to my knowledge, that research paper that you're talking about and the recommendations have not been incorporated into the enforcement strategy. It's something we can look at. I don't know, Bernie, if you want to answer the static question, if you have any information on that, if I'm understanding the question correctly. In terms of the policy, the small-scale fisheries policy, we only allocated rights in the Northern Cape in 2019, I think, and literally in the Eastern Cape 2 days before national COVID lockdown. We were in Port St. John's 2 days before the lockdown. So in terms of the policy, the 3 years is only due now. They've had their rights for 3 years as the primary cooperative. So now we've got to set up the secondary cooperative.
And we will start in the Northern Cape because that's where we allocated rice first, followed by Eastern Cape. Well, followed by KZN and then the Eastern Cape, and then lastly the Western Cape. Others,
want to tell us?
Yes, thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Just on the recreational fishing, let me first say recreational fishing is one of the important fisheries in other countries. They even use it as a fallback when stocks are decreasing because then the ecotourism, you can even catch lobster just to show people here is a lobster. This is how it looks. This is how it's fine. Because people are paying money for hotels and paying money for those recreational the person that takes them at sea to show them the type of lobster and how fine it is without even eating it. But regarding recreational fishing, what we are also intending to do in scientific and management working group is to have all stakeholders that are involved, your small-scale fishers, commercial fishers, recreational fishers in one meeting, because it's one fishery, so that when TAC is undetermined, their inputs are taken into consideration, and not to have a separate working group, but we do have ad hoc meetings when there are specific issues to be discussed with those fishing sectors. Yes, you are right, previously there was a recreational working group meeting which ended up not working properly because of various issues, as you mentioned, issues of them not being organized in one way or another. And some fishing sectors, remember recreational fishers, they will be involved in various fishing sectors. So in other fishing sectors, they are actively involved, like your anglers, they would have their associations that are organized. They always knock at the door, and they were the ones who were very instrumental in the previous recreational working group, but we are intending to try and organize them. There are various documents that we are working on them, including management plans for recreational fishing, but we will be dealing with those in the recreational fishing in that one. Thank you.
Sure, lastly, I'm just going to ask Mr. Liederman to respond on the inland and coastal SADC countries. And I don't know whether I should mention this Honourable Bryant in terms of recreational fishery, but they always say don't scratch where you don't need to, but we, in the interest of disclosure, we actually have a crisis at the moment because the recreational permit used to be purchased through the post office, and as you know, the post office is no more. And we're really struggling to find a national service provider who has a presence and a footprint in all the rural areas that can sell the post office, the recreational permit on our behalf. So people are struggling to get hold of the permit at the moment, and it's going to become worse as the summer season approaches. So you've got to get something in place quickly. Bernie?
Thank you, Honourable Members, for the question. The question in respect of the SADC is appreciated, especially the part where we need to consider conducting a study in terms of comparison and looking at specific lobster, and in this case specific West Coast rock lobster exports, and comparing that in terms of exports by South Africa and other inland and landlocked countries. As I mentioned earlier on, I'm not aware, but I appreciate the question, and it's definitely something that we can explore and look into. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Brian.
Chair, thanks. Just it's very, very two quick ones, just for clarity. So just in terms of this recreational working group, and you're going to set something else up now going forward, are you going to be working with the existing recreational working group that was there beforehand? I have no idea what it looks like. In terms of chairmanship, you said that it was completely disorganized and dysfunctional. But, I mean, are you going to be making contact with the previous people who were involved in that to get that going and get that feedback?
And then just in terms of the that research paper, so that obviously the department has access to that and has considered it, but hasn't incorporated it. What are the reasons for not incorporating it, and is it possible for us to have access to that paper? Because I've heard anecdotally about it, but I haven't seen it. Would it be possible to share that with the committee? Because I think in terms of recreational fishing, it would be worthwhile us being able to appraise ourselves for the facts. Thanks.
Honourable Branch, I'm personally totally unaware of this research study.
Okay.
If you give me the name, we can track it.
M-T-H-E-T-E, the research paper that was undertaken, I think, in 2012.
That's old.
Yeah. Not older than some of the research that we've got there. I'm going back to 2008 to be considered, so,
Okay. Let's see if we can, the scientists must have it somewhere. And then, Audra?
Yeah, just to clarify the fact.
You see, the I'm in charge. So you come with your people. It's you who forbids them from coming to portfolio. So they enjoy seeing members of parliament. This might feel like ice cream. Now we have other things to do. So they just want to speak to us the whole day. Well, you must give us time. We'll come to you there, and then we'll engage them. And then you can note us. But here you are noted. Proceed, my brother.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Just to clarify the part of recreational fisheries involvement in management working group and scientific working group. There is currently management working group for each fishing sector. So you have management working group for West Coast Rock Lobster, management working group for lime fish. So if there is an organized group for recreational fishers and representatives, then they will form part of a particular management working group. If they are anglers, they will of course form part of traditional line fish recreational management working group. If they are involved in West Coast Rock Lobster, then they will form part of the West Coast Rock Lobster management working group. That's where you meet the small scale fishers, commercial fishers. Then we discuss preparations for opening of fishing season, they give their inputs into the management of the resource. So if you have it separate, it doesn't quickly give input into the management issues, but if you have them all in one room, then it's easy to look at the fishery holistically. Hence the idea of having this one co-management meeting where we are all in one room discussing the issues. Thank you.
All right. But that's fine. You know what, we'll make a separate suggestion when we're alone, Honourable Members, that when Sue comes as the DDG, we must meet her alone and her team. And when any other DDG comes, they must come with their team. It would be nice to see DDG differing with their teams and all of that. But we must appreciate this was quite innovative. We really appreciate it, Sue and your team and all of our members. And if we are all agreed, can we close?
Yeah. Just a process issue. I think the board has also got one. But I think we might be talking about the same thing. Just in terms of minutes for meetings, I think it's been a long time since we've approved any minutes. I'm just wondering when that's going to come, because if it comes at a very late stage, it's hard to think back as to exactly what we said. So I just want to find out when we're actually going to approve those minutes, because we're going to have to do that at some stage.
And our books might also be missing where we're taking those.
I think the next meeting, sir.
You think so? Next meeting is tomorrow, are we?
No, we don't have a meeting, sir.
We'll process that on our
Yeah.
Brian.
The sooner the better.
Okay.
I just want to appreciate that we can have a face-to-face meeting. This is really good, and I hope all our next meetings will be face-to-face. And Aaron, this is a lovely venue. Look at Manfred.
Well, I know you miss me. you must just be outright about it. Honorable members, thank you very much. Thank you very much, team GFSP, and the meeting is closed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to